The iconic clock tower crowning the old Monroe County Courthouse shines like a beacon, welcoming pilgrims who've crossed the southwest Alabama sea of cotton and cornfields, spindly pines, and flamboyant mimosa trees to walk in the footsteps of Scout and Dill, Atticus and Boo. Its bright white appearance on the horizon signals our final approach to Monroeville, the literary capital of Alabama and home of Harper Lee, who set her classic novel To Kill a Mockingbird in a town modeled on the Monroeville of her Depression-era childhood. Begin your visit at the red brick courthouse on the town square. Built in 1903, the building garnered national attention in the years following the 1960 publication of To Kill a Mockingbird. And in 1991, after decades of limited use, it reopened its doors as a museum. On the first floor, you'll find a replica of a 1930s law office, as well as a great visitor information center and a large gift shop, The Bird's Nest. Upstairs, exhibits on the book and the 1962 film are brought to life with audio gleaned from interviews with Lee. An adjoining exhibition spotlights another acclaimed Monroeville writer, Truman Capote. Capote spent a large part of his childhood living with his cousins in the house next door to Lee's, and many believe that Lee based the character of Dill on her childhood playmate. She also assisted her friend with research on his best-selling 1965 nonfiction novel, In Cold Blood, regarded as a masterpiece of literary journalism. Of course, the undeniable highlight of the courthouse visit is the courtroom, which has been restored to its 1930s appearance. A spittoon sits next to a straight-back chair on the witness stand. A hand-worn Bible rests on the judge's bench. Light beaming through the tall windows and reflected off the pressed tin ceiling illuminates the setting of some of the novel's most memorable scenes. On your way out, pick up a walking tour map of 1930s Monroeville and stroll the surrounding streets, searching out buildings of significance to young Lee and Capote. Check out the former Monroe County Bank, where Lee's father kept a law office, and the storefront that once housed Thompson's Bakery, among Capote's favorite shops. Stop in at Old Curiosities and Bookshop, just a couple of blocks off the square, and splurge on a signed first edition of Go Set a Watchman, Lee's 2015 follow-up to Mockingbird, plus collections of Capote's short stories. End your day at Mel's Dairy Dream, a walk-up burger and shake joint on the site of Lee's girlhood home. Order a cone of soft serve and take a seat on what remains of the wall that once separated Lee's yard from Capote's. It's easy to imagine the pair sitting on these same sun-warmed stones some 80 years ago, admiring childhood treasures, a notched arrowhead, a gleaming cat's eye marble, a tiny bird's nest, and making up stories about their neighbors. It's hard to believe that those two little people would go on to change the face of American literature, one penning a book many regard as the great American novel, the other creating a groundbreaking work at the intersection of journalism and storytelling, and giving us Holly Golightly, the dazzling heroine of Capote's 1958 novella, Breakfast at Tiffany's. An hour and a half northeast of Monroeville lies Montgomery, the capital of Alabama and site of the only museum dedicated to the lives and works of F. Scott Fitzgerald and his wife, Zelda. It was here at a country club dance in the summer of 1918 that Scott, a 22-year-old Army lieutenant stationed at Camp Sheridan, met and fell in love with 18-year-old debutante Zelda Sire. Less than 2 years later, Scott published his debut novel, The Side of Paradise, and in so doing, won Zelda's hand in marriage. They went on to live rollicking lives in cities such as Paris and New York, staying mostly in hotel suites and rented rooms, and becoming the first couple of the Jazz Age. His 1925 novel, The Great Gatsby, would capture the unbridled energy and reckless spirit of the era. Her embrace of risque new styles and unconventional behavior, such as cavorting in the Washington Square Park fountain in Greenwich Village, would earn her the moniker America's First Flapper. In October 1931, the couple returned to Montgomery and leased a handsome two-story house in the city's Tony Old Cloverdale neighborhood. Though they only lived in the house 6 months, their time in Montgomery represented one of the longest periods of stability in their dizzyingly vagabond life. In 1989, their former residence became the permanent home of the Scott and Zelda Fitzgerald Museum. As you step through the door, the tinny sounds of ragtime and vintage jazz transport you to a bygone era. Six galleries showcase family photos, newspaper clippings, personal letters, and treasured artifacts, unfurling the stories of Scott and Zelda's lives. The first gallery chronicles the couple's early love affair, the birth of their daughter Scotty, and Scott's early successes. In the Roaring Twenties room, Zelda's flapper accessories, a beaded clutch, a feathered headband, a slender cigarette holder, trumpet the verve and abandon of the age. The neighboring gallery, titled A Great Depression, documents her struggles with mental illness and the failure of her only novel, Save Me the Waltz, as well as Scott's literary disappointments and his falling out with Ernest Hemingway. Your glimpse inside the lives of the larger-than-life couple may well leave you reflecting on the Great Gatsby. Like Gatsby and Daisy, Scott and Zelda experienced both the giddy rush of success and the gasping agony of failure. And perhaps your visit to the house they once called home and your journey back to those heady days will call to mind the novel's haunting last line. So we beat on, boats against the current, borne ceaselessly into the past. And before I leave you this morning, I'd like to take you along as we visit five storied literary watering holes across the region. Let's begin with Sloppy Joe's in Key West, Florida. This legendary joint opened on December 5th, 1933, the day Prohibition was repealed. Ernest Hemingway bought his scotch here, and every year the saloon hosts a surreal tableau, the Papa Look-alike Contest, in which dozens of barrel-chested men with manscaped white beards compete for the title. Next up, the Peter Kern Library in Knoxville, Tennessee. A Confederate veteran, Peter Kern opened an ice cream saloon after the war. His namesake bar, styled as a speakeasy, presents its menus in World Book encyclopedias, and craft cocktails are named for literary figures such as Atticus Finch, Holly Golightly, and even serial killer Lester Ballard. Next, Carousel in New Orleans, Louisiana. If the room is spinning, you're not necessarily tipsy. This elegant lounge features a revolving bar, a circus-themed 25-seat merry-go-round for grown-ups, installed in 1949. Hemingway mentions it in Night Before Battle, and Eudora Welty features it in The Purple Hat. Truman Capote also drank here. Back to Key West and Captain Tony's Saloon. Whenever a celebrity visits this watering hole, a stool is named in his or her honor. Among the inscriptions, Ernest Hemingway, Truman Capote, and Shel Silverstein. Jimmy Buffett started here and was paid in tequila. Established in the 1930s, it's believed to be the oldest bar in Florida. And rounding out our list, Battery Park Book Exchange in Asheville, North Carolina. When you found that special title among the 35,000 books on hand, break out the bubbly to celebrate. This dog-friendly hangout doubles as a wine, coffee, and champagne bar where you can linger in comfortable recliners and imbibe by the glass. You can also trade books for drinks. Join me next week as we end our travels through the literary South here in Georgia with visits to the Margaret Mitchell House, the Wren's Nest, Andalusia Farm, and more. For City Lights and WABE, I'm Kevin Benefield.